Hello, and welcome to the Optimizing 340B Program Opportunities and Compliance During the Pandemic webinar, presented by Pozzinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pozzinelli Associate Kyle Vasquez.
Thanks so much. Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon for some of you. Again, my name is Kyle Vasquez. I'm a consultant with Pozzinelli Healthcare Solutions and a shareholder with Pozzinelli PC. Happy to have everyone join us today for a discussion about optimization and compliance opportunities to use during the pandemic. There's been quite a lot of activity in the 340B space, as many of you know, in the last probably 8 weeks. We plan to discuss quite a bit about, spend some time on the manufacturer issues that have been going on of recent and get into some other topics. But first, what I wanted to do is tell you a little bit about Pozzinelli Healthcare Solutions. We are a consulting firm that really was developed in response to client demand. Many of us with Pozzinelli PC, our law firm, are former consultants and lawyers, and so a variety of us basically got together and decided that there was an excellent opportunity and time to form a consulting group to advise on some non-legal issues that we see our clients face and some core sort of areas that we work in. So we created Pozzinelli Healthcare Solutions to prepare healthcare organizations for the next generation of payment reform and innovation oversight. We reach a pretty broad continuum of stakeholders, from hospitals to physician practices, to pharmacies, specialty pharmacies, ACOs, behavioral health, lots and lots of different healthcare-focused entities. And that list continues to grow. We designed the firm around, as I mentioned, a few core practice areas. 340B obviously is our topic today. We have an FDA practice, a privacy practice, a physician alignment team that deals with innovative payment models and arrangements where hospitals align with physicians, general reimbursement and licensure issues, and other things that we may not have on this list. I'm going to skip the first bullet point here, but really focus on the second bullet point on this slide. We, as Pozzinelli Healthcare Solutions, really team up with entities to find the right balance between program optimization and compliance in the 340B space. So before I was a lawyer, I was a consultant and learned a lot of valuable sort of lessons from the field as far as optimizing programs, but also balancing that with provider risk profiles. And so in our 340B practice, what we spend a lot of time doing is trying to balance that those two concepts. And generally speaking, we see very similar approaches and balance across many different types of covered entities. But because of some ambiguity in the 340B program statute and rules, you'll see some variation, slight variation in practices. And so, you know, we try to advise along that continuum, recognizing risk profiles. And I think we do a really good job of that. And by partnering with our clients and getting involved in leadership and steering committee meetings, we're able to become a member of the team and really listen and provide feedback when we can. So today, what we're going to do is we're going to run through some drug manufacturer activity that's been percolating for the last 2 months or so. As we developed this webinar, frankly, that wasn't even a bullet point, but it's become such a hot topic that we'd be remiss not to talk about it. Then we'll go into some program optimization tools and tips, sp- specifically focusing on a couple emerging issues that have come out of COVID-19 from HRSA and APEXIS, and then some other opportunities and models that we're seeing in the marketplace. And then we'll close by going through some, and Suchi, my colleague, will go through some compliance-related matters, including Medicaid trends and HRSA audit trends. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Suchi to kick us off on the recent drug manufacturer activity.
Thanks, Kyle. So as Kyle alluded to, there have been a number of recent actions taken by manufacturers with respect to 340B drugs that are distributed through contract pharmacies. And you all may have already received these notices and been aware of what's happening, but we'd like to talk about them in further detail, as well as talk about some strategies for addressing these actions. So the manufacturer actions that we're seeing fall generally into two buckets. The first group are comprised of Lilly and AstraZeneca. These manufacturers are restricting distribution of all of their products through the 340B program through contract pharmacies. Lilly first began with restricting distribution of Cialis beginning July 1, but they have since expanded that restriction to all of its products dispensed through contract pharmacies beginning September 1. AstraZeneca similarly will be barring 340B pricing for all of its products through contract pharmacies beginning October 1. Both of these manufacturers have created an exception for covered entities that do not have an in-house pharmacy. Those entities can designate a single contract pharmacy to access 340B drugs. But all other covered entities will not be able to access those drugs. There are a number of issues that we see with this type of action. First of all, we think it's a clear violation of the 340B statute and the terms of the manufacturer's pharmaceutical pricing agreement with HHS. 340B statute says very clearly that manufacturers must offer 340B pricing on all of their products, regardless of the setting. There's nothing in 340B statute that dictates where and how a covered entity can access 340B drugs. So it's pretty clear that if a covered entity decides to use a contract pharmacy to access 340B pricing, then a manufacturer must honor the discount. In addition, the 340B statute imposes civil monetary penalties on manufacturers that commit a knowing and intentional overcharge by refusing 340B pricing on drugs where required. And we believe that this type of action could result in civil monetary penalties on these manufacturers for knowingly and intentionally overcharging covered entities. This type of action also clearly discriminates against 340B entities by singling out 340B providers as opposed to non-340B providers and accessing and denying access to pricing. It's also inconsistent with HRSA's 2010 contract pharmacy guidance, which recognizes an existing right that covered entities have to dispense 340B drugs in the contract pharmacy setting. Manufacturers have argued that this guidance is unenforceable. However, we note that the guidance doesn't establish any new rights. It simply recognizes an existing right that covered entities have under the statute to access 340B pricing in all settings, and also an existing right that covered entities have under state agency law to contract with retail pharmacies to dispense these drugs. It's also unclear whether Lilly and AstraZeneca are going to extend these unlawful restrictions to entity-owned retail pharmacies in addition to contract pharmacies. So we're still unclear on how this is going to play out in the future. The second group of manufacturers that manufacturer activity that we're seeing relates to not an explicit, necessarily an explicit restriction on 340B access through contract pharmacy settings, but it conditions access to 340B drugs and contract pharmacies on uploading certain data to a platform called 340B ESP. So The manufacturers that have taken this step include Merck, Novartis, and Sanofi. Merck has requested that this data be uploaded and has threatened more audit activity for refusal to engage. Novartis and Sanofi have gone a step further and have explicitly conditioned 340B access in contract pharmacy settings to uploading this data to the 340B ESP platform. So there are a number of issues, again, with this type of request. First of all, it jeopardizes patient privacy under HIPAA. The type of data that's being requested here is very broad. It includes all kinds of claims data for not only Medicaid populations, but also commercial and Medicare Part D populations. These are areas where, although a Medicaid fee-for-service covered any type of responsibility to prevent duplicate discounts, that responsibility doesn't lie with the covered entities when it comes to Medicaid managed care discounts, and the duplicate discount prohibition also does not apply to commercial claims or Medicare Part D claims. So essentially, these manufacturers are requesting a ton of data from covered entities with the aim of preventing duplicate discounts in areas that are not the covered entity's responsibility. And this raises issues with respect to patient privacy because of the breadth of the data that's requested. And although the 340B ESP platform and their provider, Second Sight Solutions, has discussed that they will de-identify the data, there are a number of patient privacy risks associated with de-identification. And so that is, patient privacy is a major issue with respect to this request. In addition, a number of contract pharmacies and 340B administrators have already contacted covered entities, noting that that there is, per the terms of their contracts with covered entities, there is approval and consent required in order for the entities to turn over this data. So it's important for covered entities to review their contracts with 340B administrators and their contract pharmacy vendors to determine whether there are any confidentiality restrictions in their in those terms. In addition, the 340B ESP terms of use are problematic, and many of those terms are one-sided. And so it's important that covered entities review those terms of use and understand exactly what they're agreeing to. There's also a substantial time commitment associated with uploading this data. As I mentioned before, it's a lot of data that's being requested and for all payers. And so especially during this challenging time with dealing with the pandemic, entities might already be strapped for resources in terms of responding to this type of data request. And again, it's unclear how exactly this data is going to be used and whether it could be used to not only deny access to 340B pricing in the contract pharmacy setting, but also with respect to in-house pharmacies. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kyle to talk about strategies to address these manufacturer actions.
Thank you, Suchi. And if folks have any audio problems, if you're having a hard time hearing, just keep please letting us know in the chat function so that we can continue to address volume issues. So I hope you can hear us now, and we'll keep going. So in terms of strategies, I think we've been very busy talking with clients about operational issues and talking through advocacy, informal and formal dispute issues, and then potential litigation on the legal side. And so because of we've spent a great deal of time in this in the last few weeks, we sort of recapped a list here of things that I think are sort of the key issues of that organizations should be looking at as they develop their relative strategies. And all of this, what I should have said on these next two slides is also make sure you engage your in-house, you know, legal and advocacy resources early and often on this stuff, and if you need to, external counsel. But it's important that those stakeholders are hearing the message and participating in all of this, because this is a really significant issue. And I don't think in my time that I've been in the program, I haven't seen this much coordinated effort by manufacturers in some time. And so I think there's a real chance that this activity could set some very dangerous precedent. And so, frankly, I'm not surprised that we're seeing a lot of covered entities, pharmacies, retail pharmacy organizations, et cetera, really taking a part in a role and responding to this stuff. So in terms of a multi-prong approach, I think one of the first things that everybody needs to do is before engaging in advocacy and letters and litigation or what have you, I think it's important to take a step back and study the potential financial impact. So, and I have in parentheses here, some versus all, I think it's important to look at, okay, if Eli Lilly, with their denial of access to 340B pricing contract pharmacies, what does that look like for us on an annual basis? How does that impact our, you know, community benefit and other programs that we provide to the residents of our community? Expand that to the five manufacturers that are currently involved in these efforts that we mentioned. So you get a sense of, you know, best case, this is where we're at, worst case, this is where we're at. And then frankly, I think it's important to communicate across your organization, leadership across your organization, what your total contract pharmacy benefit really is, because I think logically we can, you know, expect that there are probably other manufacturers considering this type of strategy and just sort of waiting to see how all of this shakes out as the first handful of manufacturers really dive in and make their way through all the nuances of this. And so that's why, again, I think it's really important not just for quantification, but also understanding the long-term potential implications so that you know what level of involvement and advocacy and such that you should engage in. Next one here, develop operational and patient impact statements. So take that data that you just pulled on, you know, the impact to your program and translate it into what it means for your hospital and the programs that you offer. I think those types of impact statements, having those handy and ready when you engage in discussions with, you know, manufacturers, when you engage in discussions with members of Congress, you have those stories to tell, and there are those stories out there. I know that there are a lot of organizations that we work with that have really developed those stories over the years after seeing Energy and Commerce Committee testimony and other things percolate. They've spent some time really pulling this together. Now I think it's even more important to do that. And obviously, hospitals on the front lines dealing with COVID issues, I think it's really a compelling story to tell, and also clinics. Develop a coordinated advocacy approach. So there's a lot of different things going on. There's sign-on letters that 340B Health and other organizations have put out there to HHS. You can write individual letters to HHS. You can write individuals to manufacturers, members of Congress, et cetera. I think it's, from my perspective, it's important to do all of those things and be coordinated to the next bullet point. Be coordinated in your efforts with the national trade associations who work in your space. There's a lot of good work that's being done. I think there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration, but also a lot of opportunity to outline your specific story and needs. And I think that was a really helpful point when providers stepped up and really reached out to Congress in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a couple members of the Energy and Commerce Committee have now gotten involved and have said basically the manufacturer should stop doing this. This is not the right time. So keep it up. And like I said, it's important to coordinate with everyone. And I've learned that over the years in working in my coalitions and partnering with providers that it's really important to collaborate across the continuum. All right. Oh, and then the last point here, coordinate with peer organizations. So there may be an opportunity, and we've seen this repeatedly over the years, to work with your peers who may have common issues, right? So you may provide a ton of clinical research on your campus. So it may be an opportunity to see, what does that mean in all of this? What does that mean in this larger story? So come together and talk about these issues, and you might be surprised at the strategies you come up with. All right. Engage in informal HRSA dispute resolution is the next task. So given the issues involved in this, I think for example, for Eli Lilly, as that manufacturer has now started denying access or changing pricing in the price files so that there is no 340B price for contract pharmacies, I think it's important to document that unavailable price and then to submit that to HRSA, either via a PEXIS's form that they make available or via your own template. I would encourage anyone thinking about doing this that if you use a PEXIS's template, that you modify it, you supplement it, you really tell your story with all of the facts in terms of what you've done to work with the manufacturers, what you've done to sort of push back, what they've said in return to you, and what prices have been unavailable, so that you have a very complete administrative record. And that, from a legal standpoint, you can talk with your in-house folks about this, but as you think about would we ever file an action, it's important that you have a very complete administrative record, because it's very hard to get in any additional evidence, testimony, et cetera, in an administrative action once it's filed. So really do your homework in advance is the key message here, and engage in all of these activities so that there's a clear record. That really gets into the next point of lay the foundation for potential litigation. Our understanding is there's some trade associations that are looking at filing an action relative to Eli Lilly, and that action would be under the Administrative Procedure Act, and basically would be an action that tells HRSA to HHS to enforce its statute, to enforce the pharmaceutical pricing agreements with manufacturers so that they stop doing engaging in the activities they're engaging in. There may be other opportunities, other options, specifically relative to the data collection effort that we've been talking with folks about, and happy to share more information about that for those that have questions. I don't want to go too much into that strategy on here. Work with split billing, third party administrator software vendors to modify program exclusions. So don't let this sit. Don't, as far as like Eli Lilly and the others, if they're going to remove 340B pricing from the price files, you need to work with those vendors to ensure that those drug claims are excluded so that you don't inadvertently incur a bunch of extra costs associated with dispensing fees. Most relationships are probably set up as what we call a winners only model, so that hopefully those would get filtered out if, for example, the drug is still at a wholesale acquisition price, some higher price than 340B. But I have to believe that there will be certain circumstances where things like this will get missed, and entities will not only suffer the loss of access to 340B, but they'll also incur fees that they shouldn't have. So just be mindful of that and be collaborative. Some of those vendors are already proactively excluding things, but we've seen others publish forms that you have to fill out to actually implement. And then the last two bullet points, something to consider long-term, just from a business standpoint, consider the impact on your contract pharmacy relationships overall. You may end up with pharmacies that don't fill a lot of prescriptions. You may end up with pharmacies that you just need to look at the economics of things and think about whether you need to shift stuff around a bit. And the last thing I'll say, watch for pricing, price file changes relative to your entity-owned retail pharmacies. Relative to Eli Lilly, we're starting to see, whether it's inadvertent or not, we're starting to see changes where the 340B price is not available for those accounts that pertain to in-house pharmacies. That was not really supposed to be the intent of that approach, but we're seeing that, so be very mindful of that, because that could impact your in-house strategy. Consider other issues like restructuring contract pharmacy, affiliated contract pharmacies, so that, you know, if you have pharmacies you own that were previously structured as contract pharmacies, it may be worth the time and the effort to discuss, does it make sense to make those entity-owned pharmacies? You have to think about some other regulatory issues like the GPO prohibition, but it's probably the time to consider those changes given that there is this sort of ongoing attack of contract pharmacies. All right. With that, let's turn to program optimization. So, first we're going to talk about some flexibilities that have come up due to COVID, and then go into some general optimization concepts and models that we are advising on. So there's three concepts I'll go through relative to sort of the COVID pandemic, but they're not necessarily waivers. There are really no express waivers that HRSA has granted. They've granted what we call program flexibilities, what HRSA is calling program flexibilities, that tend to apply to registration requirements and other areas, or they're just seeking to clarify things. If you recall, you probably know that HRSA has had some challenging situations where manufacturers have challenged their regulatory authority, and so they're very cognizant of that and very careful about their approach, which rightfully so, in terms of do we have authority to actually change certain areas in the program. So just keep that in mind. We're talking about flexibility versus actual express waivers like you'd see with CMS and other agencies. On all of this, when in doubt, one recommendation here is when in doubt, ask for some sort of flexibility. You'd be surprised at how flexible APEXIS and HRSA have been. Frankly, it's been really great working with them on a number of different initiatives where we've had clients that have really been struggling, you know, due to COVID situations, and HRSA has been more than happy to sort of hear the issue, listen to the issue, and then react to it in a way that's very helpful. So, and I encourage you to reach out. All right, the first flexibility is expedited use of 340B drugs in new off-site locations. This one came as quite a surprise early this summer. We had heard some rumors that HRSA was changing their approach to when you could use 340B drugs in a new, what they call child site, which is a provider-based site. Historically, you had to wait until those sites actually appeared as a reimbursable cost center on a filed Medicare cost report, and then you could enroll it the quarter after that site appeared, and it's effective even the quarter then beyond. So sometimes it would take, you know, a year and a half before a site was actually able to use 340B drugs. This change is pretty drastic because it could escalate the use of 340B products, you know, a year and a half. I was skeptical about this change when I first learned of it. And so, frankly, I spent two or three weeks slowly and methodically talking to HRSA and APEXIS and wholesalers to make sure that everybody was really aligned in terms of what this means. And so in that work, what we've discovered is HRSA views this as more of a clarification of what always has been going on in the marketplace and not a new policy. And so you can sort of read between the lines in terms of why they would say that. But the FAQ is here on the slide, and really what it says is you can use 340B drugs at a new outpatient facility before it shows up on a filed cost report and before it's registered. There's still an expectation that the site does appear on a cost report and does get registered, but if a patient meets the patient definition, you can utilize 340B drugs at that location, both physician-administered drugs, and you can qualify contract pharmacy prescriptions from visits at that location. We have verified this, frankly, a couple different times with HRSA and really probed them and asked so many different questions to try to make sure that we weren't missing something. And, I mean, I think we're talking to other stakeholders in this space like us. We all, again, went into it a bit skeptical and now have come out of it understanding that it really is a useful tool for covered entities. This is a permanent change, not a clarification, or because it's a clarification, there's a permanent change, it's not specific to COVID. And as I mentioned, it applies to physician-administered drugs and contract pharmacy prescriptions. So some issues to consider before you implement anything around this. A key issue is provider-based compliance. It still has, the site still has to be a reimbursable cost center. It's got to show up on a filed cost report at some point. And to be able to do that, the location actually has to meet the provider-based rules that we cited here on day one. So when it opens, should meet those rules. Otherwise, I would not use 340B products at that location. Because of the importance and the tie-in now with provider-based and the fact that the reimbursable cost report isn't driving the day one offering of 340B products, I think it's really important to either file or internally document provider-based attestation for every one of these locations, just to make sure that you've crossed your T's and dotted your I's, so that if HRSA ever tries to sort of weigh in to, you know, provider-based issues, even though I don't think they will, but if they tried from an audit standpoint to make sure that 340B drugs were properly used, you have something to point to say on such and such a date, here is proof that we were meeting the rules that will ultimately lead to a reimbursable cost center. Consider the impact of Section 603 site-neutral payment implications. This is just a flag that if you open a new site under certain circumstances, it's going to be subject to the Bipartisan Act, Budget Act of 2015 and face site-neutral payment policies. So it's just something to highlight so that financial analyses that are done are factoring this in. Work with your split billing vendor and TPA to implement. So just, you know, basically the mechanics of making sure the vendor recognizes it as an eligible location and that they include data feeds for e-prescribe and other data in order to get 340B eligibility for contract pharmacy prescriptions. Collaborate with wholesaler to avoid supply chain and delivery issues. This is something that came up in our sort of informal discussions with the wholesalers, just to make sure we were all sort of aligned. Wholesalers rely on the 340B database, OPACE, as their source of truth for audit purposes, chargeback purposes, et cetera. So this is a real struggle for wholesalers to help and work with covered entities to implement. So there may be certain circumstances where a covered entity has to receive delivery of the products at a different location in order to, and then basically get them over to the unregistered child site. Of course, you'd have to consider state law and other issues, DEA, other issues, to make sure that you can actually do that that type of transport. But this is, again, just a flag that this is an issue, and hopefully you can avoid those supply chain considerations. Update contract pharmacy agreements to expand definition of child sites. So now, as folks go through the cycle of sort of renewing or getting new contract pharmacy agreements, just keep this new or this clarification in mind so that you capture that in the language of the agreement. And then update policies and procedures. So as the FAQ I read off mentions, it's important to document this approach in your policies as HRSA directed. Okay, and then this is a sort of bonus add-on to the strategy of potentially expedited use of 340B products. There are, for DSH hospitals, there are certain location exceptions under the provider-based rules. So typically, hospitals can open provider-based sites as long as they are within 35 miles, the straight line as the crow flies distance. There are obviously situations where hospitals are in certain geographic areas where those sites are located beyond 35 miles. This slide is intended just to highlight that there are certain opportunities and exceptions in the provider-based rules to exceed that mileage limitation. These aren't tested all that often. There's very little guidance on it other than what's in the provider-based rules. There's been one in particular ALJ opinion on the applicability of all of this, but just know that you can go beyond the 35 miles if you meet certain exceptions. And I've highlighted two, the DSH exception, which really in some ways mirrors the 340B eligibility requirements for DSH hospitals. But I did note there that the child site may need to further the purpose of the indigent care agreement. So it's a further tie-in that you need to be aware of that I'm happy to answer questions on. And then there's also a 75% exception where you can do a zip code analysis and see where all your services are provided. And it may be that there's enough crossover that you can justify a provider-based site that's greater than 35 miles. In most cases, they have to be in the same state. There are certain states that are adjacent to one another that have collaborative agreements where you can cross state lines. It's not all that common, but just know that that's out there. All right, the second program flexibility, telehealth. We get a lot of questions on this in terms of how this works and the cost report and such. Telehealth is nothing new when it comes to 340B. Telepharmacy and telemedicine have been used as a basis to, or 340B prescriptions have qualified on the basis of telehealth or telemedicine, but HRSA sort of went the extra mile and published an FAQ to suggest that telehealth is just one modality that can be used to meet the patient definition. So this is not a COVID-specific waiver or flexibility. This is just a reiteration of, a clarification of HRSA's understanding all along. The MEGA guidance, some of you may be familiar with if you've been in the program as long as I have, that was never finalized, but HRSA did propose a huge sort of reform to the program years ago, but didn't go through with it. It's just nice to know that there was language in there about telehealth, telemedicine. So it's clear that HRSA has always sort of recognized and been on board with it. So as long as you have auditable records and you have policies indicating how telehealth fits in to the 340B equation, this is something that could potentially be used. And then I'll talk about implications here. So some issues to consider. Some operational issues, maintenance of sufficient documentation in the clinical record and in the right place. Usually it's pretty clear that telemedicine is documented right in the hospital EMR. We've seen certain circumstances where because telemedicine originates out of like the physician arm of like an academic medical center, it may be a separate entity. They may use a separate EMR instance even of the same EMR. We just have to make sure you work through those issues and that the documentation is right in that hospital EMR, because that is one of the key, one of the core requirements of the patient definition. Are telehealth services reported as reimbursable cost center services? So this comes up quite frequently. Where do we report? The question is, where do we report telehealth visits from a cost and revenue standpoint on worksheets A and C, the cost report? I think there's enough flexibility here where you might potentially avoid those issues, and HRSA may provide some flexibility and recognize that telehealth could be reported in some unique line. But I think long-term, if you're developing a telehealth strategy with 340B as a focus, you just are mindful of where you report those services and really try to get them between lines 50 through 118 on the cost report, so that there's just no question. I just worry that like 5 or 6 years from now in an audit, you know, an auditor looks at where prescriptions are qualifying from, and if they see telehealth, they want to know where telehealth is reported on your cost report, that you have a good answer. So that's the key there. And then can your TPA accommodate? That's just a basic operational question, making sure that they can implement around this. And then just be aware of there's frequently conflict between state and federal telehealth licensing scope of practice and reimbursement issues. There's been tons of waivers and things that may remain permanent relative to CMS federal reimbursement policy around telehealth. But certain states have caught up, others haven't. So there's this constant tug and pull between federal and state rules. So just be aware of that. And as you pick the sort of model and the clinicians who are going to provide the telehealth service, you want to make sure that you take a step back and make sure that there are no other barriers to doing that. And we've done a lot of like 50 state survey work around that and can help. All right, and then the last HRSA program flexibility, expedited site contract pharmacy registration. So this really ties back a lot in some ways to the first one. HRSA posted an FAQ that essentially says if you're seeing a surge in cases relative to the pandemic, you can reach out with those concerns and seek expedited approval. This one is temporary. I mean, there's been certain situations pre-pandemic where we've argued for expedited enrollment and have succeeded. It's very rare, though, that you see HRSA do that. So, again, this one is likely temporary. And note that 35-mile rule exception I talked about earlier may also apply in a helpful way here. Again, going into some operational issues to consider. Consider the interplay with the above child site and telehealth matters. So this all could kind of fit and align together. Is there a reasonable basis to to request expedited review. I mean, I have seen very rare situations these days where there isn't a real good business case. In many cases, it's very, very clear. In others, you know, maybe around telehealth where we have to make a more attenuated argument, but I think there's definitely ways to do this. What will the effective date of the registration be? That's a question that comes up frequently. A lot of times we're seeing the registration, even if they allow it like today, outside of the normal registration window, it still may not be effective until the next quarter. So just be mindful of that. You should be asking, can we do an off-cycle registration and can we get an earlier effective date? And then again, work with your split billing software vendor to implement. All right, and just to sort of close the loop on this one, if you're intending to use any HRSA program flexibilities or you're wondering if there are more, we encourage you to consult the HRSA COVID resources page as well as their FAQs, but just know that some of those FAQs may seem conflicting at times, and that's because some of them may be somewhat out of date. And then confer with APEXIS FAQs. We've seen alignment on a lot of these issues in those FAQs, so but if there are any questions, obviously you can reach out to any of those organizations or to us and we can help clarify. All right, another fairly common model outside of the flexibilities that we're seeing as far as program optimization, and I would say in some ways a reduction of the time and effort associated with compliance, and in a good way, is the use of clean sites, clean child sites. So hospitals oftentimes have infusion centers or other areas that administer very complex, high cost, high sort of acuity involvement drugs. And in many cases, those products are subject to prior authorization and other, you know, other things with insurance companies. So it's really, really clear who's an eligible patient under 340B and who's not. And in most cases, before the patient even sets foot in the building. The term clean sites is just more of like a industry term, and it's basically taking those types of locations where you know all your patients are 340B eligible and you have very minimal exposure as to other non-eligible patients. You can consider sort of flipping the traditional contemporary inventory model on its head. So most larger hospitals are using what's called a virtual inventory, where you use data after the fact to determine if someone was 340B eligible or not. Here you say, well, we know right off the bat that everybody's eligible. So we start with 340B products, and we just monitor them to make sure that that's always the case, that everybody is eligible. If you're a DSH hospital under the normal model, you would have to start with a WAC purchase of every product, which is expensive in these cases, and then switch to 340B once you have the requisite patients to do that. A lot of times those NDCs change, products are discontinued, products evolve, so you're constantly buying things at WAC. So this is a way to try to help minimize that WAC exposure, but also remove the complexity of the virtual inventory process and spend your time focusing on patient care. What types of locations benefit? Largely infusion locations, things where you keep a limited inventory around on hand. It's really just, we know we're using this amount of product this week. We know the patient's already approved for our location. And so it's easy to administer. Some issues to consider, we talked about if they're primarily eligible patients. Does the site carve in or carve out a Medicaid? This is probably the biggest risk point for one of these clean sites. So if you are a Medicaid carve-in location, in theory, everybody would qualify for 340B, including Medicaid patients. If you're a carve-out location, technically you're supposed to be providing non-340B products to Medicaid patients. So you have to be prepared to deal with that. So in most cases, this is a model that's used, I think, more easily and more efficiently when you're a carve-in facility. And then, of course, can the split billing software accommodate? And I would document in your policies why your justification, your business case for this. All right, and lastly, joint venture and other affiliation tools. This is something else. I put this in here just because we're getting a lot of A lot more activity again in this space. We're seeing a lot of community hospitals who are looking to try to get more involved in, for example, like more robust cancer care, haven't historically had the physicians, haven't historically had the expertise to do it, and are looking for ways to partner with other larger hospitals to roll out this type of model. I'll let you review the slide. What I've done is basically provide options and sort of ways to navigate this. One common question we get is, can you joint venture a child site? The clearest answer I can give you is only if it's on campus to the hospital that's going to bill for the facility fees. There may be other models which are captured in the very small text that you probably can't read that well right now, but if you print out the slide, you can. But the right side, there are models that you can use to try to engage that partner and pay a fair market value fee for services, including management agreements, leases, employee leases, other things when that joint venture prohibition comes into play. All right. I've outlined a couple top issues to consider, but for purposes of time, I think I'm going to skip through those and go to this last optimization slide quickly before I turn it back over to Suchi, because I'm cutting into her time. So I apologize for that. Other optimization strategies, we talked a lot about the manufacturer issues. There are some manufacturers that are limiting access to like orphan drugs and other types of medications. Consider there are other opportunities potentially to get access to those products, either just access in general or access to 340B. We've seen some co-ops being developed where there's data sharing with manufacturers on clinical outcomes and such. There's just other tools in the tool chest that can be used to think about, and don't just take no for an answer is really the message there. Strategies to expand the CE's continuum of care. We talked about hospital-hospital affiliations like joint ventures or things that look and feel like those. Consider specialty pharmacy partnerships. I think right now, specialty pharmacies should be a real emphasis. There's benefit there. Your patients benefit. Payers are looking to reduce the cost of specialty pharmacies. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. And then engage your PBMs and payers. I can't tell you if those discussions will be fruitful in every case, but I think it's important to highlight the tug and pull between narrow networks and 340B and how it impacts 340B, and try to work with those PBMs to get in network if you own your own pharmacy, for example. I think those things can be really helpful for your program. All right, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Suchi.
Great, thanks, Kyle. So the next topic is compliance. And compliance is really a key element of 340B optimization because non-compliance can lead to significant repayment to manufacturers of 340B discounts. So that's why we wanted to cover this topic in this webinar. We could probably do an entire webinar on just compliance topics, but for this one, we wanted to focus on a couple of big issues, including Medicaid, 340B policies, as well as HRSA audit preparedness. So with respect to Medicaid policies surrounding 340B drugs, there's a lot of variation that we're seeing at the state level with respect to billing, reimbursement, as well as claims identification. Some of the focus areas that we're seeing particular issues or problematic policies in are outlined here, and I'm going to go through each of these in detail. So with respect to fee-for-service retail 340B drugs, so these are drugs dispensed in your retail pharmacies that are billed to Medicaid fee-for-service. Some of the problematic policies that we're seeing include a mandatory carve-in of Medicaid fee-for-service drugs and billing at actual acquisition costs. Illinois and California are a couple examples of states that have implemented this mandatory carve-in policy. It essentially forces the covered entity to carve in and receive a lower reimbursement at actual acquisition cost than And in California, a big update is that the California governor has signed an executive order that requires all pharmacy services to be consolidated under the fee-for-service umbrella. by January 2021. This impacts Medicaid managed care drugs because essentially all of those drugs are now required to be billed to fee-for-service and thus subject to the mandatory carve-in of 340B and billing and actual acquisition costs. It also impacts contract pharmacies because normally contract pharmacies are required to carve out fee-for-service but can carve in Medicaid managed care drugs. But with all of the pharmacy services consolidated under fee-for-service, these contract pharmacies will effectively be forced to carve out Medicaid. We have seen other states who have already implemented these policies or are planning a similar policy. New York Medicaid, for example, announced that it would be transitioning all pharmacy services under fee-for-service effective April 1, 2021. A more favorable policy for covered entities is reimbursement at the 340B ceiling price for these fee-for-service drugs. The 340B ceiling price sometimes allows covered entities to, who are accessing drugs at below 340B ceiling price to retain the difference. And that can be more favorable, and a couple of states have already implemented reimbursement at the ceiling price. With respect to 340B physician-administered drugs, currently CMS policy, federal regulation requires actual acquisition cost billing for all drugs, including 340B drugs, that are dispensed through retail pharmacies, but there's no federal mandate that actual acquisition cost reimbursement is required for physician-administered drugs. However, we are seeing some states that are extending that requirement to physician-administered drugs, and it sometimes shows up as a surprise provision in what's called a state plan amendment. That's the document that states have to submit to CMS to obtain approval for any changes in reimbursement. And so it's important to look out for some of those surprise provisions that might show up, even though states are required to provide notice to stakeholders as well as an opportunity to provide comment on changes in reimbursement policies. Sometimes states don't do that. And so it's just something to be aware of as well. So another problematic policy we're seeing is in the Medicaid managed care space. So as you know, the 340B statute has a duplicate discount prohibition. That prohibition applies to fee-for-service drugs. So in essentially it means that covered entities have the responsibility to repay the 340B discount when a duplicate discount occurs on a fee-for-service claim. However, when it comes to Medicaid managed care claims, that's really a responsibility for the state to repay the rebate. It's not the covered entity's responsibility to repay the discount. However, we're seeing states shift that responsibility to the covered entity to repay the discount. And there may be, we believe that states lack the legal authority to do so. So we've also seen some states implement mandatory carve-out policies, and this policy essentially forces a carve-out of Medicaid in all settings, contract pharmacy, in-house, physician-administered drugs. And for hospitals that are subject to the GPO prohibition, it essentially forces those hospitals to purchase that WAC. Because they cannot purchase at the GPO price. So this is problematic. New Hampshire has implemented a mandatory carve-out policy. Other states have attempted to do so, but have not always passed due to advocacy. And in Delaware originally proposed a mandatory carve-out policy, but as a result of covered entity advocacy, CMS required Delaware to establish a carve-in request process that covered entities could request to carve in. So advocacy has been helpful in this realm. Another problematic policy we're seeing is states relying on the Medicaid exclusion file, not only for fee-for-service drugs, but also for managed care drugs. HRSA has made pretty clear that the exclusion file is only intended to apply to a covered entity's carve-out for carve-in selection for fee-for-service. But we are seeing states extend that to managed care, which has a number of problematic consequences, including that it effectively forces the managed care, forces the covered entity contract pharmacy to carve out managed care because they're required to carve out fee-for-service. And so when you align, when you use the same carve-in-carve-out selection across fee-for-service and managed care, it effectively forces a managed care carve-out as well. And finally, we are also seeing mandatory contract pharmacy carve-out policies implemented in some states. So these are, what I've discussed are examples of problematic policies that we're seeing, as well as some favorable policies. I think what's most important as a key takeaway here is to remain proactive when it comes to keeping track of Medicaid policies and revise your policies and billing practices accordingly. These policies change frequently and they continue to evolve, and reviewing them on a periodic basis, whether that's monthly or quarterly or alongside with your regular internal audits, is key. We've also been proactive in keeping track of updates in Medicaid policies in various states, and so it's important to stay on top of those changes and ensure that you're implementing the different requirements as they roll out. In addition, it's important to think about being reactive in terms of providing duplicate discount data analysis and reporting. And I'm going to just quickly turn it over to Kyle there to talk about some of the work we've done in that space.
Yeah, thanks, Uchi. I'll be quick. So, the issue of pulling together purchasing data, Medicaid data, basically pulling in data from a variety of sources to figure out, did we buy a 340B and did we pass that discount along or use the right modifiers on claims? That exercise can be complicated. We actually have done a lot of really good data analytics for different clients to help facilitate that and facilitate communications with states to try our best to get the states to actually work through those rebates with manufacturers directly. Again, I've had a lot of good luck with that and have just developed a tool to kind of get through those exercises fairly quickly. So,
great. Thanks, Kyle. So I know we're limited on time, so I'm going to go ahead and move to the next section, which focuses on HRSA audit preparedness. This slide presents sort of a step-by-step, these are the first HRSA begins with an audit notification and then proceeds to coming on site and doing transaction testing and field work on site, and then ultimately issues a report with findings that the covered entity has an opportunity to contest through a notice of disagreement is what the challenge is called. And finally, HRSA will issue a final audit report that will require the covered entity to develop a corrective action plan that must be approved and then ultimately issue manufacturer repayments. So on this slide, we presented some of the significant risk areas that we're seeing in HRSA audits. Obviously, a violation of the GPO prohibition is an eligibility requirement. Complying with the GPO prohibition is an eligibility requirement for hospitals, and therefore a single violation can result in removal from the program as well as extensive repayment. So that is one of the, I would say, one of the more adverse or significant findings that could occur. And I'm going to go ahead and move forward to, let's see here, potential future audit issues. So, Kyle discussed the HRSA's new policy or clarification, as they call it, with respect to pre-registration of child sites and use of 340B before it appears on the Medicaid cost report or Medicare cost report. We've yet to see how that will play out in audits and whether HRSA is going to kind of dig into documentation of provider-based eligibility or whether they'll simply ask for policies and procedures that reflect any changes at the entity level. In addition, we've yet to see how and whether HRSA will incorporate program flexibilities during COVID-19 into their audits, as well as one issue we're seeing is negative accumulations that could result in a diversion finding. We might be seeing more of that in a virtual inventory model as well. So given that we have just 1 minute left before we wrap up, I'm going to go ahead and move it over to the questions from the audience.
Yeah, Suchi, I think one of the questions here was a good one. Any predictions on whether HRSA will stop the current manufacturer trends? I wish I had a great prediction there. We know that HRSA is looking more closely at Eli Lilly's actions and has not posted their updated limited distribution plan yet, and that's intentional. I'm not sure we're going to see them stop that one. I do think there's some trade associations just kind of waiting to see, and you might see some litigation around that soon. And then something we should have mentioned, a question we got was on 340B pay, this Calderos model. It's still pretty sort of premature on that. We're looking at that. We know GlaxoSmithKline might be one manufacturer that intends to participate. That would really flip the 340B model upside down into a rebate model. For many of the same reasons as we know, identified on the Eli Lilly slides, we don't think that that's appropriate. We would expect HRSA to get involved in that process as well. Someone asked about the 75-75 rule. The test, or not asked, but stated that that's an annual test, and that's correct. So if you're trying to exceed the 35-mile limit, that's an annual test. And I don't see any other audience questions at this point. So we can probably wrap up.
This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the Posanelli website within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.